Book of Ruth is one of my favorite books. I guess everybody knows a couple of lines from the Book of Ruth because we oftentimes hear them at marriages, you know. Kind of ironic because it was something said by one woman to another woman. It really doesn't have anything to do with getting married, but it's still good thoughts. The Book of Ruth sits smack dab in the middle of the long historical books of the Old Testament. And it always has been there. It's one of the books called the Writings. The Old Testament was divided into three parts by the Jews: the Torah, the first five books, you know, the books of Moses, the Law. Then the Writings. Those were the historical chronicles of the Jewish people, and then the prophets, major and minor. And Ruth is one of the historical writings. It's the shortest historical writing because it's less than 4 pages long in your Bible. Next shortest is the Book of Esther, which is another one about a woman. And you know, you just get done with Judges and all the bloody battles, and then comes this charming little idyllic pastoral story, rural country story. It's a favorite of, I suppose, most people that have read the Bible, whether Christian or Jewish or not. And everything turns out right. You know, as long as you aren't cheering for Naomi's husband and sons, everything turns out right, because her husband and sons die in rather short order. But there, you know, one commentator on the Book of Ruth said, one of the nice things about the Book of Ruth is that there aren't any bad guys. They're all good guys. Naomi's a good guy, and Ruth's a good guy, and Orpah's a good guy, and Boaz is a good guy. You know, there aren't any bad guys. Now, there certainly is reference to evil in the story. But all of the people that are characters in the story are fine people. And it's a kind of a welcome relief, particularly after the Book of Judges, kind of a welcome relief to read a story where everybody's quite nice and quite likable for a variety of reasons. Let me give you a little data that we can work with, and then we'll go into the story, and it would be kind of nice if we took turns reading, and then I'll comment on it. If anybody else has any comments, feel free. If you visualize the land of Palestine is going like this, and here's the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River, and then the Dead Sea coming down here. The land of Moab is on the other side of the Jordan from this area here, which is Samaria, Galilee, Judea. It's on the other side of the Jordan. It is located today in the country of Jordan. It, as far back as we have history, has been an agricultural area. It is the primary source of grains for the country of Jordan. It also, Jordan also does a certain small amount of grain exportation. When the Jordanians are getting along with the Israelis and vice versa, there's some, you know, selling across the river of grain. So it's always been a very fertile agricultural area. And by the same token, the area around Bethlehem, which is where the home of Naomi is, the area around Bethlehem has always been and still is today kind of marginal agricultural. Bethlehem is located 5 to 6 miles south of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a It sits in a little valley up in the mountains, just like Holden Village does. And if you could imagine Lucerne down by Lake Chelan, and no Lake Chelan and no mountains on the other side, that would be about, and think of Holden villages located like Jerusalem, that would be about the relationship, except that we're 12 miles from Lucerne rather than 5. But you come down from the mountains into a kind of rolling country, which is marginal agricultural, which is why there's a lot of sheep raising there even today, and that's why the shepherds were out with their sheep the night that Jesus was born. You know, so it's land that is used for sheep raising is land that's not much good for anything. And so you can imagine that what it must have been like at the time of Ruth and Boaz. Now, they apparently at that time were able fairly successfully to grow some crops, because when Ruth and Naomi come back to the land, it's just about barley harvest time, and then there's a reference to wheat harvest time. Now, barley is referred to in the book as corn, and then it's, which is a kind of a generic word that they use to mean grain. And then there's reference to the barley harvest. Well, even today, in the area around Bethlehem, where they have little pockets of fertile soil, they still grow barley, and they still grow wheat, and it's a 2 to 3 crop harvesting country, just as central Southern California is. The climate is pretty much like Southern California in this part of Palestine. And so, you know, when one crop's been harvested, then they plant another one. And so barley was usually harvested in the early part of June, and wheat was harvested in the late part of August. And Ruth gets in on both of them during the course of the story. By virtue of the fact that this is mountainous country, whereas the Transjordanian area, at least for a while, is kind of river plain area, the weather is kind of uncertain around Bethlehem, whereas it's fairly reliable on the other side of Jordan. And in the Old Testament history sources that we have other than the Bible, there is an occasional reference to a famine time in Palestine. Now, you know, the Bible has 2 records of famine times in Palestine. One is at the beginning of the book of Ruth, and the other one is at the time of when Joseph is sold into captivity by his brothers. You remember, then there was a 7-year famine, and everybody came to Egypt to buy supplies, because up in the Palestinian area, there wasn't rain, and they just weren't getting the crops in. So the Bible has 2 records of famine and bad agricultural times in southern Palestine, those 2 times, and we know from other sources of other ones. So, kind of unpredictable, but on the other side of the Jordan, Moab was one of the salvations of Palestine in times of need. Now, it's also important to pay attention to the names of the people who are in the story, because all of the names mean something. One of the names, we don't know what it means, but all the other names, we do know what they mean. Elimelech is the husband of Naomi, and Elimelech means God is my ruler, God is my king. I suspect that the fact that his name is Elimelech was intended by the storyteller to say to us, kind of subtly, this was a believing family. This was a family that was serving the true God. Mahlon is his older son, and Mahlon means sickness, wasting away, not in good health. I can't imagine somebody having a child and naming that child sickly or something like that. But that's what Mahlon means. Kilion means dying off. That's the other son, dying off. And as we know from the story, they both died without issue. And daddy died too, and that wiped out the family. Well, maybe daddy was a kind of a sickly person, and the little boys when they were born were kind of sickly also, and being hard-nosed realists, as certainly Naomi is in this story, very realistic, practical, down-to-earth, earthly woman. Maybe she named her boys for that way for that reason. Naomi's name is my pleasant one, my charming one, or joy of my life. And judging by the kind of, you know, the loyalty that her daughter-in-law has felt toward her and the reception which she got when she got back to Bethlehem, she must have been an extremely popular woman. And as her name testifies also. Ruth means friend or friendly. And that name has a kind of special meaning in our family because about our middle one of our children's name is Ruth, and she's the friendliest one we've got. She's everybody's friend in the village. And she reminds me a bit of the Ruth in the story here. Orpah, who is the other daughter-in-law, well, there's some disagreement about what her name means. One of the interpretation of her name from the Aramaic is stiff-necked, proud, conceited. And another one is coming from another language background is the cloud, light, fleecy, floating cloud. I think one's got to be careful with the stiff-necked interpretation because, as I'll try to point out later on, she was a nice girl. And, you know, she goes nothing bad about her. She's suffered by comparison in our eyes with Ruth because Ruth was the one that went along with her mother-in-law. But at the same time, Orpah is the one who did what she was told, and Ruth didn't.
Thank you.
Okay. Boaz, we don't know what that name means. Obed, the child which they had, means worshiper or servant, true servant, and probably reference to carrying on the tradition of service to the true God. Near the end of the story, there's a reference to Ephratah. And you know the messianic passage, but thou Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the province of Judah, yet out of thee shall he come forth who shall be great in the eyes of the Lord. Bethlehem Ephratah. Ephratah was the name of the area, the geographic area where Bethlehem was located. And it has no special significance. Now, there is a reference in the latter part of the story to being fruitful like Rachel and Leah and so on, who were the two wives of Jacob. There is this kind of reference by the people in Bethlehem because Rachel was buried near Bethlehem. Jacob brought her body and back from Egypt and buried it near Bethlehem. And so the Bethlehemites even today feel strong associations with Jacob and his wives, particularly his favorite wife, Rachel. And Jacob's well still exists and still functions in the vicinity of Bethlehem. So Jacob associations are very strong among the Bethlehem people, and so when they think about happy marriage, fruitful marriage, quite naturally their thoughts will be, may you have a marriage like Jacob and Rachel did, where Jacob worked for 14 years. Pardon me. Worked for 14 years to earn Rachel's hand from the hand of his cheapskate uncle Laban. Okay, which is, you know, another one of the great love stories of the Old Testament. Okay, a couple other references. A measure. There's a reference to Boaz giving Ruth so and so many measures of barley. A measure is about a third of a bushel. There's also reference to an ephah. She gathered so and so many ephahs of grain. An ephah is about two-thirds of a bushel. And I guess that's enough pure information to give you some background. Look at the very first sentence. Long ago, in the time of the judges, there was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah went to live in the Moabite country with his wife and his two sons. All of the best stories, they say, begin with once upon a time. And that's the way this one starts out also. Once upon a time, in the land of Judah, there lived a man with his wife and two sons. So it tosses you, it gives you a kind of a vague historical reference. At the time of the judges, well, the judges were judges for about 300 years in the time prior to the first king, Saul. So we're living in the pre-monarchic Israel. It's a time where Judah is fairly well settled. The tribes that had inhabited Palestine before the Jews came had been driven either over to the coast or up to the north. And the Judah area was fairly secure. And so consequently, it's a fairly peaceful, pastoral kind of situation. And to the extent that there's reference to non-Jewish people, Moabites, Ruth and Orpah, there seem to be, you know, relaxed relationships. It's not a kind of situation where you say, well, the Moabites are all right, but I sure wouldn't want my son married to one, because both sons marry Moabite girls, and it doesn't seem to sweat anybody at all. So ethnic relationships, at least at this time, seem to be very, very relaxed. And there are no wars going on, at least at this part of Palestine. So we have a man who's from Bethlehem in Judah, and there's reason for saying Bethlehem in Judah, because at this time there was another Bethlehem that was up north in Galilee. So you had to say Judah Bethlehem, not Galilee Bethlehem. So this is at Bethlehem in Judah, and they went to live across the Jordan in the Moabite country because there was a famine in the land. Now, as we'll find out several chapters later on, these are farm people. Elimelech leaves his farm in Palestine. It's just a little too bitter, you know, very, very small. But it is a farm, and he leaves his farm because crops just aren't coming, and there's probably no rainfall, and so things are withering, and they leave the land, and they go to Moab to see if they can make a living there. Okay, the man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephraimites from Bethlehem in Judah. Now, it's important that the writer mentions that, because tribal background was extremely important among the Jews and among certain conservative Jews today. They're still very concerned about their tribal background, you know, and particularly if they're from the family of Joseph or if they are Levites. This is a special status even today among conservative Jews. They are Ephraimites living in Bethlehem. Well, Bethlehem, as we all know, had been given to which son? To Judah. That's why it's called Judea. But they're from the family of Ephraim, who were farther up north. But what had happened was the land which Ephraim really got cheated when they parceled out the land. Because Ephraim got the hunk of land to defend, which was right in the middle. And it was where the best fords across the Jordan River were. And so consequently, you know, it was about as viable an area as the area where Troy was located in Asia Minor, guarding the Hellespont. Anybody that got any kind of power would come and knock you down because you blocked the economic approaches to the Black Sea. Well, Ephraim was constantly having to fight big countries who wanted to move through his country for economic reasons. And so two things happened. A lot of Ephraimites just simply went and lived someplace else because life was too uncertain in the area of Ephraim. And other Ephraimites enjoyed this kind of life. They began to mix culturally and ethnically with pagan groups, and they got to be the libertines of the Jewish people. After a while, to be an Ephraim, the public image of the Ephraimite was to be an Ephraimite is to be a drunk. And finally, the Ephraimites were just simply killed off by the other tribal people because they had become intolerable. They were fighting against the others. And then all of a sudden, after they had killed off all of the, well, they killed off all the women and children. And then all of a sudden, they thought, hey, we just wiped out a relative. What are we going to do now? And they put a curse on them, and no one was to marry any of the male Ephraimites that were left. And then they thought, well, what are we going to do now? Well, we can't rescind our curse because curses are always irrevocable. So you can't rescind a curse. And we can't let the Ephraimite family die out. So what they did was they said, all right, if there are any girls that don't have any marriage prospects, and if they happen to be kidnapped by any Ephraimite males that happen to be around in the woods hiding out, we won't run too fast. And that's how they restored the Ephraimite family. But it ended up being mixed because they intermarried with some of the other tribal groups. All right, which has absolutely nothing to do with the Book of Ruth other than that these are from the tribe of Ephraim and they're not living in Ephraimite country. So they're kind of expatriates from their area of Palestine, and that's why the author mentions it. They're not descendants of Judah. Okay. Yeah. Doesn't even mention what? That they were from. Well, in the Hebrew, it says they were Ephraimites from Bethlehem in Judah, and. I don't know, your translator maybe wasn't sensitive to the importance, you know, for the Jewish people anyway, the importance of that. But the point of the writer in adding that point, I mean, it's not just a casual point. The point he's making is that they are people who had moved to this area originally from the land of Ephraim, which was farther up north.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. How then... somewhere I forget where it is. I mean, they trace the fact that Jesus is in the New Testament. They trace the fact that Jesus is of the house of David, and they go back. You know, when Ruth married Boaz and so on. Well, now then, if Ruth's family were Ephraimites and they just migrated or whatever you call it to Bethlehem, well, how did they get a blood relationship to the house of David then?
Oh, David is a descendant, as you'll see at the end of the book, because Obed will be his great great or great 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 grandfather. But I think for the Jewish people, one of the primary importances of the Old Testament Jewish people, one of the primary importances of the Book of Ruth was that it showed two things. One is that David's ancestral blood was not pure Jewish, and so he has an ecumenical background. And they always associated David with world supremacy. David and Solomon were the ones who made Israel important, world leaders. And that's when they really got on into the big time. And the only time in their history when they were big time. And so to say that, you know, David was, David had some Gentile blood in his background. It was very important. The second thing is also to indicate that that David has mixed tribal blood. In other words, he's not just a one tribe ruler, but he's ruler of all the tribes, and he has a mixture of several tribal blood in his veins. This is why many scholars of the book of Ruth have thought that perhaps Samuel wrote the book, and that it was written for its political value. Now there are others that think that it's a very late book, and maybe one of the last books of the Old Testament written because it's kind of vague on history at the beginning. It simply says long time ago this happened, and that it's simply the preservation of an old story, which is true. Nobody ever wrote it down, and then it got written down in late times. I kind of like the Samuel bit because it'd be kind of fascinating if this very charming story was written to make David look good in the eyes of his people. But at any rate, that's the situation. Okay. So they arrive in the Moabite country and they stayed there. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she is left with her two sons, and each son marries a Moabite woman. Now, in retrospect, as we get better acquainted with Naomi and see her as a very practical, pragmatic woman who all her life has been concerned with the problem of survival, human survival, you can imagine that very likely the death of her husband certainly stimulated her to push her sons and to assist her sons in finding wives to such an extent that she doesn't say, look boys, one of these years things are going to be better back in Palestine, and let's wait. You know, don't pay any attention to these girls, nice looking as they may be, nice as they may be. You just wait and marry a good Jewish girl when we get back home. This isn't the kind of woman she is. This is a time in Israel's history when it's still a question of survival. They have not completely subdued the land. They are not masters of their economy. And one of the important things in life with survival is to have descendants. Now, her husband has died. Her husband had no brothers. So, there's nobody that's compelled to marry her. She's not going to have any more children, even though she probably is still a fairly young woman. And so her sons have to get married and have to have children to keep the family line going. She owes this to her dead husband. Now we don't think that way, do we? I mean, we don't have that kind of mentality. But raising up sons to the honor of their father and grandfather's name was an extremely important idea among the Jewish people, primarily because it was it was survival times. And a woman in her fruitful years was extremely sensitive to this kind of idea. And so consequently, you can imagine Naomi being very concerned to find daughters-in-laws, to find wives for her two sons. And if her two sons were sickly, and if her husband had been sickly, and that's why he died fairly young, You can imagine that she probably looked for a couple of strong, husky farm girls to improve the stock. See? And so she was probably very concerned to find a couple of good, strong, husky, hard-working girls for her, you know, kind of fragile sons to be married to. Well, she finds Ruth and she finds Orpah, and her sons marry them, and in fairly short order, her sons die. Okay, there, that's the end of the family, as far as Naomi can see. She has failed in her primary responsibility, and that is to raise up children to the glory of the family name. And she decides to go back to Palestine. The two daughter-in-laws are close to her. They offer to go along with her. Now, there may be a mixed reason for their offering to go along with her. I don't want to make them look not as nice as they are, because I think they were both quite nice, thoughtful women. But it may well be that by virtue of having married Jewish men, that, you know, their marriage prospects weren't that hot in Moab anymore. At the same time, you know, Naomi encouraged them to go back, and it might have been better. They're young widows. They might only have been 17, 18, 19 years old, and widows. And a widow was not the most popular commodity in Palestine and the Palestinian area. Now, it may also be that the Moabites were less tough with widows, you know, than the Jews. And while on the one hand the Jews had the Levitical rule, where the younger brother had to marry the widow of his older brother and raise up children to the memory of his older brother, and so on, it made that the thing cut the other way also. Because, you know, when we have to do something, if we can possibly avoid it, we don't. And so, by virtue of having the Levitical rule, any other guy, eligible, marriageable guys that were around, tended not to be interested in young widows, because, you know, they were somebody else's obligation. And so what it tended to do was to make a woman less desirable for marriage. And so it didn't always work for the purpose that it had been created. Although it certainly worked great for Ruth, didn't it? So Naomi, in her practical way, was probably thinking about this when she said, look, you girls, you know, you're Moabite girls. You're Gentile girls. You're nice girls, but you're Gentile girls. You come back home with me to Palestine, you know, nobody's going to want to marry you. You're still young, you still got your youth, you know, stay here, find yourself a nice boy, get married, settle down. This is sort of Naomi's thinking, and she's thinking very practically, very pragmatically. And what she also adds to this is the thought, and this kind of jars us. And she says, look, you got your Moabite gods. I got my Jewish gods. Stay here, worship your gods. I'll go home, worship my God. And that really gets us, doesn't it? Particularly when it's the Jewish woman who is saying this. Tells you something about their attitude toward Yahweh in those days. And particularly in the latter days of the judges, it was extremely casual. And they even, and this is late judges days, and even you'll find in the book of the judges where the Jews are working angles. Let's see what Yahweh can do for us. Now, what offer does Baal make? You know, we'll take the best offer. And this is why you're always finding them falling away from God, because they got a better offer from Baal. And then they have to get punished so that they wise up and come back to Yahweh. And so there is a kind of casual attitude toward religion. And when we then encounter the statement of Mary, of Ruth, who says, your people will be my people and your God will be my God. The word which we have there in Hebrew is not the word Elohim, which is a kind of a general, non-denominational, generic word for God, but the word we have there is Yahweh, which was the proper name among the Jewish people for God. And so Ruth is saying to her, your people are going to be my people, I will be Jewish, and Yahweh will be my God. Showing a considerably stronger religious faith than Naomi had. And that's one of the ironic, remarkable aspects about this story. Okay, so Elimelech died and she's left with her two sons, and the sons marry women of Moab, one of whom is called Orpah and the other Ruth. And they lived about 10 years. Mahlon and Chilion died. Now that 10 years in Moab, that's from the time they came until the time they left, and we don't know how many years they were there before Mahlon and Chilion got married. So it's somewhere in that 10-year period that they got married, and they apparently died fairly shortly after there. So now poor Naomi is bereaved of her two sons as well as her husband, and she decides to go back home, because she had heard while still in the Moabite country that the Lord had cared for his people and had given them food. The famine is over. She starts heading back to Judah. But then as they're going, Naomi has some second thoughts. And she says, go back, my daughters. Why should you go with me? And they say to her, we'll go along with you. And Naomi looks at them and she says, look at me, I'm an old woman. Can I have some more kids? Can I produce a husband for either of you girls? A very practical, pragmatic woman. She says, I'm not going to have any more kids. Chances of you Gentile girls over in Palestine finding a husband, nil. You go back home, get yourself a husband. I understand. A likable woman, but at the same time a very pragmatic, practical, worldly woman. And then as we see Naomi, the marriage maker later on, the same way, very down-to-earth, practical woman, and she knows how to land a husband for a girl. Okay, morals mean nothing to Naomi. The name of the game is survival. See? Okay. So Orpah obeys her. Orpah, well, they all cried together for a while, and then Orpah kisses her mother-in-law, goes back to her people, but Ruth kept hanging on to her. She gave her a big hold and hug, and said, I'm staying. And Naomi says, look, your daughter, your sister-in-law went back to her people and her gods. That's a thing to do. She was a good girl. See? Now, and Orpah was a nice girl. She did what her mother-in-law told her to do. She went back. Now you go and do that too. And Ruth says, please don't try to make me desert you. Where you go, I'm going to go. And that's one we all know. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people are going to be my people, and your Yahweh will be my Yahweh. Where you die, I will die and I will be buried. And then she takes an oath before Yahweh. Not before her Moabite gods or anything like that, but she takes an oath in the face of Yahweh that nothing but death will separate them. Well, Naomi says, all right, let's go. And they come to Bethlehem. And you can just see, now bear in mind, Bethlehem is a little town. Maybe 500-600 people living there. So when a stranger comes, that's a big deal. And especially when it's somebody like Naomi whom they haven't seen for 10 years. And you can just see Naomi walking up to town and they see her coming. She comes into the village square and all the ladies come and gather and they hug one another. Oh, Naomi! Yeah, where's your husband? Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. The boys! Oh, hey! Oh, who are these nice-looking young ladies? And she introduces, or who's this nice, yeah, Orpah's back home, isn't she? Who's this nice-looking young lady? Oh, this is my daughter-in-law. Oh, how nice to see you. And, the clutching, the coffee clutching going on there in the town square. And there's a lot of hubbub, and then word spreads all around town. Naomi's back. And her husband died, and so on. And there's great excitement about them, and the women say, can this be Naomi? The pleasant one, the joyful one, the happy one. See? And Naomi says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. Mara means bitter. It is a bitter lot that the Almighty God has sent to me. Now, that's the second time in the story that she said, oh, God has really been hard on me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. And there's a kind of an interesting play on words there, because the reason why they left Palestine was because it was empty of food. And they went to Moab that was full. And now she comes back from Moab. So it's just kind of a little play on reverse meanings. Why do you call me Naomi? The Lord has made a decision against me. The Almighty brought disaster on me. This is how Naomi's daughter-in-law, Ruth the Moabitess, returned with her from the Moabite country. Now, that's a comment by the writer. And that's how Ruth came to Palestine. See, it's like saying, end of Act 1. That's how Ruth came to Palestine from the Moabite country. And the barley harvest was just beginning when they arrived in Bethlehem. See? Now, notice how beautifully this thing is written. It starts out, it gives you the setting, the characters. We set the situation, and now we're ready for the main story, the love story of Ruth and Boaz. And at this point, then the author says, that's how Ruth got there, end of Act 1, and we'll take a break while we change tapes in the back room. Couple minutes to stretch, and we'll pursue the marriage. Okay. All right, Naomi has a kinsman now on her husband's side, a well-to-do man of the family of Elimelech, whose name is Boaz. See, now we're introducing the hero. We've gotten the heroine and the situation all set. Enter the hero, beginning of Act 2. And he is presented in a very heroic way. Ruth says to Naomi, can I go out to the cornfields and glean behind anybody who will let me do it? And Naomi says, okay, fine. I mean, here they are back at Bethlehem. They got nothing. You can imagine that all of the friends, fixed them up with a little food in the pantry to get them started. But, somehow or other, they're going to have to survive. Yeah.
I have one question. Wouldn't Boaz be at the house of Judah?
You have to watch your genealogy, because whether it's the genealogy of Joseph or of Mary. See, and Mary was of the house of Judah. Yeah. And but Joseph comes from this line. You have to watch which is which. Plus, there was also intermarrying with the family of Judah as you come up to David. So that means David could legitimately say, I am the house of Judah, and I'm from Judea. Okay? All right. So Naomi gives her permission to go out and glean in the fields. Now, let me comment a little bit about gleaning for the benefit of anybody that doesn't know anything about gleaning. Gleaners, and there are still gleaners today. I'm sure you're all familiar with the famous painting called The Gleaners. It shows the women gathering up grain, and that's in France. There's still gleaning goes on in France today and in Austria, because in some of the rural areas of France and Austria and Germany, peasants still exist. Can you imagine that in the 20th century? There are still peasants who have small farms and who do everything manually. Most of them are quite elderly in their 70s and 80s, but they plant and they harvest everything manually, no machinery, because they can't afford it. They're too poor. Well, anyway, a gleaner was a person who came after the harvesters. The gleaners were all poor people, indigent people. And what they would do would be to follow after the people who were doing the harvesting, and they would pick up the stalks of grain, the occasional stalks of grain that got left behind. So it was a kind of form of social welfare. And that's how poor people who didn't own land and farms were able to survive. And they go to a farmer and they would ask him if they could glean his field. And he'd say, fine. And he'd say, I've already committed the field to certain gleaners. And then they go to another field. But anyway, they could have whatever they could pick up. You remember, you know, those of you that are as old as I am and older, you remember back in Depression days? What an awful lot of people did for fuel. You went down to the railroad tracks, you know, and you went in the area where they loaded up the coal car, and you picked up the coal, you know. I did it when I was a kid, maybe some of you did too. And you picked up coal lying along the tracks, and that was fine with the railroad company. They didn't
care. Well, I just read in California that they were allowing the poor or the... people to go on the vegetable fields and pick up the heads of lettuce and stuff that they
are left over. Yeah, yeah, and it's that same kind of idea of gleaning. So they, and plus related to it was the idea of things not going to waste. Mm-hmm. So poor people then would come and they would go behind the harvesters and they would pick up whatever was left over. Now there was a divine law which they had gotten from Moses that said that they were not to harvest the corners of the field. Now it was good agricultural sense too, because you know if you come around in a sweep, is a lot faster and more efficient than working your way into the corner and then going on a right angle from that. You can do it easier. So they would just kind of cut the corners short, and then the gleaners could have what was over in the corner. And it was a kind of way whereby poor people got taken care of. So Ruth and Naomi, now they're two indigent women, and Ruthie says, I'm going out and get us some grain. And she just happens to go to the field of Boaz. And she comes there, and when she gets there, Boaz is just coming out from Bethlehem. Now, tells you something about the way people lived in those days. They didn't live out in the fields. They lived in the little town. It was a farmer's town. They lived in town. Their house was in town, primarily for mutual protection. See, with a wall around. Same sort of thing happened in the Middle Ages when life was very unsettled and the walled towns developed. And nobody lived out in the country because, you know, anybody, any thief that came along could kill you and take what you had. So they lived in town. And so Boaz was living in town, and so did his workers. But at crop time, they had little temporary sheds, just like farmers nowadays have in the truck farmer area, you know, where their migratory workers live while they're there harvesting. So they had little sheds out in the field, and the men would stay out there until the harvesting was done, and then they'd go back into town again. And they'd harvest, and they'd also guard their crops that they had harvested. So at any rate, just as she gets the field, there comes Boaz out from Bethlehem. And Boaz greets his reapers, saying, the Lord be with you. And they answer, the Lord bless you. And this is put in by the author of the story to tell you that Boaz was an extra special kind of person. He wasn't just your ordinary farmer hiring his migratory reapers, but he expresses the blessing of the Lord to his workers, and it's obvious from the response that they give him that they like and respect him. So this is put in just to very rapidly sketch in the character of Boaz, to create an attitude in you toward him. Beautifully done from a literary style. Okay, so the answer, and then he asks the servant who's in charge of the people that are reaping, who's the girl over there? And they said, well, she's a Moabite girl. She just come back with Naomi from Moab. And she asked if she could glean here and gather behind the reapers, and she's been here since early dawn, and she's been working without resting at all from that time on. So Boaz walks over to Ruth, and he says, listen to me, my daughter. Notice the father-daughter relationship that he's expressing here. Little does he know that he's about to get it. But he takes a fatherly attitude toward her. You're cute the way the thing is written. Listen to me, my daughter. Don't go and glean in any other field, and don't go any further. Keep close here to my own girls that work for me. And watch where the men are reaping and follow right behind them. I've told them not to give you a hard time. Now, there's a bit more in that also than that, because when a girl is very poor and very indigent, you know, and when reapers are farm laborers, weren't particularly known for their morals. A girl was ripe pickings for any guy that had some ideas. So at any rate, he had already told his workers, I don't want anybody touching this girl. So he probably had more than just a fatherly interest in her at this point also. Okay, so he says, stay here. I've given orders to my workers not to hurt you in any way. If you get thirsty, go over and drink from the jars that my men have brought out here. Now, this was a special deal. See, gleaners were expected to look out for themselves. I mean, after all, they're scavengers. And Boaz here is taking a special attitude toward her. They had brought out the jars of water from town, from Jacob's well in town, and water's at a premium out there. They have to haul it out there, and so it was a special favor of his to say to her, look, if you get thirsty, you just go over and have a drink from the water that we brought out here. Okay. She falls down in front of him and says, why are you so kind to notice me when I'm only a foreign girl? And Boaz says, they have told me what you have done for your mother-in-law since your husband died, that you left your father and mother in the land of your birth, and you came to a people that you'd never known before. May the Lord reward what you have done. And may the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge, give you all that you deserve. Now, this is a kind of a cute line that the author has put in here, because later on, when we get to threshing time and Naomi's advice is, go and crawl under the covers with Boaz there when he's asleep and let him take you under his wing. And then Boaz's response, when he discovers her down there and is horrified, Melanite, and is most concerned to protect her reputation, then he finally decides he's got to make some kind of arrangements for this nice girl to get married. He uses the expression once again in talking to the unnamed relative who has a greater right than he to marry Ruth. And he says, will you take her under your wing? And then finally at the end, he says, I have taken her under my wing. So this taking under the wing is used a number of times in the story in a number of kinds of senses. All righty. she responds, "Sir, you have eased my mind. You have spoken kindly to me. May I ask you as a favor, please don't treat me like one of your slave girls." Now, she can see that he's showing some interest in her, that he's treating her specially, and she's thinking, I wonder what his angle is. See? And so she says, "Please, you know, if you got any bright ideas about me, you know, and reciprocity, you know, forget it." Except she says it politely. Okay. Mealtime comes around and Boaz says, "Come on over here and sit down and have something to eat. And dip your bread into the sour wine." Standard food for harvesters in those days, and they say also still today, was a bitter wine and parched grain. Grain that had been...
vinegar.
Well, they served vinegar also for anybody that wanted to use it. But they used a very sour wine. And I suppose the primary reason for it is the same reason why, you know, in hot, dry weather, we'll drink lemonade. You know, or something else like that that has a sour taste to it. But they serve sour wine and vinegar and, you know, parched grain. And so he offers some food to her, and so she sits down with the reapers, and he hands her some roasted grain, and she ate what she wanted, and she had some left over. What'd she do with that? She stuck it in her pocket for Naomi. Okay. Then they get up to glean, and Boaz says quietly to his boys, "Let her glean, you know, right up close in among the sheaves. Don't chase her away or bawl her out or anything. And it won't bother me any if you, you know, accidentally drop a little bit and start, you know, around her." Oh, it's cute how he looks out for her accidentally. Now he's also aware of the fact that this is a very proud girl. See, she doesn't want charity. She wants to earn what she gets. And so, you know, he's saving her face for her at the same time. But anyway, so Ruth gleans until evening, and then she beats out the grain from what she had gathered together, and she's got about a bushel of barley. And she gathered it up and took it back into town, and her mother-in-law saw how much that she had gotten. And then Ruth also brings out the parched grain that she had saved from lunch, and her mother-in-law says, "Where did you glean today? Blessings on the man who looked out for you today." You know, because nobody could possibly have gleaned that much grain without a little help from the owner. So she told her mother-in-law, who she had been working with. She says, "His name is Boaz." And Naomi says, "Blessings on him from the Lord. Oh, the Lord has kept faith." You know, you can see Naomi. "The Lord has kept..." You know, this is the one that says, "The Lord has cursed me. The Lord has kept faith with his beloved." He's a relative. See, the head is starting to... The wheels are going around already. He's a relative. Now, let's check the Levitical law. Does he owe us anything or doesn't he? Very practical girl, Naomi. Okay. "This man is related to us and is our next of kin." Well, he was second next of kin. So she tells him, Ruth says, "What's more, he told me I should stay right up there with his men until they had finished all the harvesting." And so Naomi says, "Yeah, I think that's best. You go and you work with Boaz's girls. Don't work in any other field." And so that's what she did. And she gleaned until the end of both the barley and the wheat harvest, but she kept on living with her mother-in-law. In other words, what that means is she didn't stay out in the fields at night. She came back home at night. She was a good girl. And this is about 2 months' worth of harvesting that she's involved with. Okay, now that's about the end of Act 2. Comes Act 3. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, says to her, "My daughter, I want to see you happily settle down. There's our kinsman Boaz. You work there with his girls. I understand tonight that they're going to be winnowing barley at his threshing floor. I got to tell you about winnowing. What they had done so far now is they had cut the grain and they had stacked it. Now they had to get the grain separated from the stalks. Well, it had to be stacked for a certain period of time so that it got good and dry so that the kernels would break loose easily. Now, a threshing floor where they winnowed the grain would be located on a high place, like a hilltop or a mountaintop or something like that. And they'd load up there, they'd pile up their grain into big stacks, and then they'd haul it up to that area. Now, it would be an area that had been leveled out quite smoothly, and then they had pounded it and pounded it and pounded it so that it would be about hard as a rock and fairly smooth. Then they'd sweep it nice and clean. They'd dump their grain down. They'd take their flails, which was like a long stick and then a short stick, fastened to it by a leather thong so that when you went like this, the top thing went flying, went splat, splat, you know, like that. And then they'd go up there and they'd pound the grain and they'd stamp on it. And they'd just pound the whole business, you know, like years ago we used to pound rugs, you know, to get the dust out of them. And then they would gather up the straw and move the straw. Then what you'd have left was the grain and the chaff. Right, then they'd maybe pound that a little bit more, or maybe the chaff was loosened from the grain. And then they would wait until they had a real nice windy day, and then they would take something like a shovel, and they'd shovel up and they'd toss it up in the air like this, and the chaff would blow away and the grains would fall back down. And so after they did this for a while, finally they got rid of all the chaff and they could sweep up all the grain and put it in baskets and things like that and take it away. So anyway, they have come now to the point where they're going to separate out the grain. So she says, wash and anoint yourself, you know, put on your war paint, you know, because you're going out to get yourself a man tonight. Put on your cloak, go down to the threshing floor, but don't make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, notice where he's lying down. Then go there, sneak over there, turn back the covering at his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what to do next. Okay, so there's Naomi's very practical, pragmatic advice. Now,
you know, and
especially he's the boss, and he's surrounded by all of his laborers, and everybody says, oh, I see, the boss gets a little extra service. He's down there, and it, you know, it's strictly a male operation. No females are on. There's no, none of the girls are there. It's all the guys. And they eat good, and they drink good, and, they glean in the late part of the afternoon because you get a late afternoon breeze that springs up and comes in from the sea, and so that was a good time to thresh. So she does what she's told. She comes in quietly, she turns back the covering of his feet, and she lies down and she goes to sleep. And he's asleep already. About midnight, he kind of turns over and he feels something with his foot down there, and he, you know, he says, who's that? You know, who are you? And she says, I am your servant, Ruth. Spread your skirt over your servant because you are my next of kin. And guys wore skirts as well as girls in those days, and you can about figure out what she was saying. Now, when she says, because you are my next of kin, what she's saying is, exercise your right as he who has the right and the responsibility to carry out the husband's responsibility for the dead man. Now, what she's saying is, you know, be a husband to me, and assume your responsibility to marry me. Okay.
Does Boaz know who he's related to?
Yeah, except that, bear in mind, Boaz knew what Naomi and Ruth didn't, that there was somebody else that was closer. See, and so this is why he, you know, this is why he made no effort to even though he quite obviously liked Ruth, this is why he made no effort to do anything about it. Because he knew that his was not the right of succession for marriage. And so, you know, that's why. And of course, Naomi didn't know this. And so now he's stuck. See, this is the complication. If it weren't for this, you know, he said, "Terrific, Ruthie, my girl, you know, we'll see the rabbi in the morning." See, but what he has to do is to, you know, keep her at arm's length until he has gotten everything arranged. Now, Boaz is not stupid, as we'll see in the next chapter. And he has now decided this is going to be his woman. I mean, she lets him know she wants him for her husband. He likes her. You know, what else do you need? Okay, so he says, "The Lord has blessed you, my daughter, this last proof of your loyalty." Now here to her departed husband and his family. "Is greater than the first. You have not sought after any young man, rich or poor. Set your mind at rest. My daughter, my daughter, you know, I will do whatever you ask for, as the whole neighborhood knows you are a very capable woman. But are you sure that I am the next of kin?" You know, here they are, you know, Romeo and Juliet, this is not. There they are out on that threshing floor. You know, she's snuggled under his blanket and everybody's around sleeping and he's afraid somebody's going to wake up and her reputation is going to be ruined. You know, and there they are discussing the Levitical succession, you know, hardly romantic. Are you sure that I'm the next of kin? There is a kinsman of yours even closer than I. You just spend the night here, and in the morning, if he's willing to be your next of act as your next of kin, well and good. But if he's not willing, I'll do it. You know, if he won't marry you, I will. I swear it by God. A more pragmatic marriage proposal was never given in the history of the world. Okay, but these were not romantic times. Okay. So he says, "Lie down now until morning." Now the reason why he says lie down until morning was so that, you know, if she got up and slipped out at this time, you know, one of the guys might be half awake and wake up and see her sneaking out and recognize her and so on. So he wants her to stay there quietly until they're sure that everybody is really fast asleep. Yeah, until early dawn, and then she can quietly slip off. Plus, he wants her to wait until dawn lights. You know, might be somebody along the way that would accost her, a thief or somebody like that, somebody coming to steal somebody's grain. And he doesn't want her to get hurt. So stay here until it's light, you know. And so she stays here quietly. And then when it's light, she can see her way home. But before the men are waking, she sneaks off and goes home. Okay. Because she rose in before anybody could be awake to recognize her, and he said, "It must not be known that a woman has been to the threshing floor. That would be a scandal." But before, yeah.
Marriage in that part was more of a business deal with Ruth.
Oh, sure, it had to be.
It wasn't.
Yeah, for sure, because you're living in rough, tough survival times. You know, if you think back to the frontier days of our country here, you know, there are a lot of stories about the shipload of girls that came around the Horn to San Francisco, you know, and then, you know, marriage was arranged.
With Marvin?
Well, sure, because, you know, it was survival of the race, and they wasn't that secure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he says, "Look, before you go, give me your cloak that you had on." Now, actually, it was a cloak that she had over her head and that she also had over her face, you know, because this is the way a woman showed modesty. She says, "Give me your cloak." Well, he pours a bunch of grain into it, 6 measures of barley, which was quite a bit, and then he helps her get it onto her back, and she goes into town. And she gets home. Naomi says, "Well, how do things go?" Dying to find out what had happened. And Ruth tells her everything that had happened, and he gave me these 6 measures of barley because he didn't want me to come home empty-handed. And Naomi says, "Okay, just, you know, we've played our card and now we sit back and wait. Boaz will see to it that things are taken care of. You are going to have a husband. It'll be Boaz or the other man, but you're about to get married. You know, everything's worked out fine. He will, I know Boaz, he will not rest until he has gotten the matter settled today. And that was true. Okay, Boaz goes up to the city gate, to the town gate. Right inside the gate was where the marketplace was. That's where all the guys hung around when they weren't out working. That's where all the business got transacted. That's where they exchanged goods and, you know, all that sort of thing. And that's where, you know, they held their casual form of law court when anybody had a dispute with somebody else. So Boaz comes up there and he's sitting down, and after a while the next of kin comes by and he says, "Hey, come on over here." Now it's interesting that the author of the book of Ruth does not tell us the name of the next of kin. I mean, even here he says, "Here," he cries, calling him by name. He's left totally unidentified because the author doesn't want us to have any positive or negative feelings about that guy. He wants us being different to him so that all our feelings are concentrated on Ruth and Boaz. Okay, so he stops 10 elders of the town and asks them to sit down and do so. And apparently it was a custom at that time that you had to have a certain number of witnesses to a transaction. Apparently the 10 elders, the guys, the town council, they had to be there and see the transaction. Now Boaz plays it very, very cute. He says, "You remember that strip of field that belonged to our brother Elimelech?" Now it's not literally brother, but it's relative. "To our brother Elimelech. Naomi's come back from the Moabite country and she's selling it. I promised that I would mention it to you and ask you whether you want it in the presence of these who are sitting here, and that'll make it official." And of course the other guy responds, "Well, sure, you know, I can always use another piece of land. Yeah, that'll be great." To which Boaz responds, "Oh, by the way, there's a little hitch. There's a female that goes along with it, Ruth the Moabite. She comes with the land, you know. You marry her, you get the land." And you can just see this other guy, you know, there's kind of a double take and a... Oh, no. And he comes up, you know, whether this is true or whether this is just a way to cop out, we don't know, you know. But he says, "Well, you know, I've got an inheritance coming, and, you know, and if I marry that way, I got to give up my other inheritance. See, you know, if I marry Ruth, see, now I get the inheritance of the son of Elimelech and his land. But then I've got to give up my own inheritance because now I'm living to the memory of another man. And so lands that I would inherit in my own right, I've got to give up because I no longer am my own person." See, now, whether this is true or not, we don't know. Whether he was, you know, trying to save face as he was backing off very hard, you know. And Boaz, you know, very straight face, said, "Well, I can understand how that is, you know. Yes, I can appreciate that. I know that if you could, you would do right by, you know." You know, all the time he's saying inside, "Whoopee, I handle it right." Okay, so he says, "Okay, now, you know, do your duty as the next of kin, if you can. If you aren't going to do it, somebody else will have to do it. So tell me, and I'll know because I'm the next of kin after you." And so, at any rate. He says, "I can't act myself, for I would risk losing my own patrimony. You will have to do my duty as the next of kin. I cannot act." Okay, now we're told about an old custom in Bethlehem. In those days, when a property was redeemed or exchanged, it was a custom of a man to pull off his sandal and give it to the other one. This was a form of sealing the bargain, just like today we shake hands to seal a bargain. Okay. And so Boaz declared to the elders, or the next of kin said to Boaz, "Acquire it for yourself," and pull off his sandal. In other words, his shoes represented his rights to it, and so he takes his shoe off and he gives it to Boaz and says, "All right, you stand in my shoes and exercise my right." That's apparently what it was intended to mean. Okay? So, Boaz then says, you are witnesses that I have acquired from Naomi now all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Mahlon and Chilion, and that further I have myself acquired Ruth the Moabitess, wife of Mahlon, to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the deceased with his patrimony, so that his name may not be missing among his kindred and at the gate of his native place, here Bethlehem. You are witnesses. Now, this is the formal legal statement which Boaz makes, and it shows that Boaz apparently was a fairly good, you know, practical lawyer. Okay, so the elders and all that were at the gate said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make this woman who has come to your home like Rachel and Leah. See, the two great wives of Bethlehem. The two who built up the house of Israel, may you do great things in Ephratah and keep a name alive in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Now, the reference here to Tamar, you remember Tamar was a prostitute, a Gentile prostitute. She's one of Jesus' ancestors, too. She married Perez. And so they refer to her because Ruth is a Gentile also. Not that Ruth's a prostitute, but Ruth is a Gentile also. And so they're saying, may your Jewish-Gentile marriage be as successful as that one was, your interracial marriage. Through the offspring the Lord will give you by this girl. And so Boaz married Ruth and made her his wife, and they lived together, and the Lord caused her to conceive, and she bore Boaz a son. And the women said to Naomi, so you can see all the old ladies getting together, came to Naomi, blessed be the Lord today, for he has not left you without a next of kin. May the dead man's name be kept alive in Israel. The child will give you new life, Grandma, you know, and cherish you in your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who has provided better for you than seven sons, has borne him. And Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap, and she became his nurse. Today we would say, and she became his babysitter. Grandma looked after him, and you can just see, you know, Naomi, oh, joyful, pleasant Naomi once again with her little grandson. Okay. And the neighbors gave him a name. Naomi has a son. Now, what the Aramaic equivalent of that is, we don't know, but it's sure not Obed, because Obed means servant, servant of the Most High. Naomi has a son. We will call him Obed. And Obed was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So I was wrong before. He was the grandfather of David, and Ruth then was David's great-grandma. And so at the end, then, we get the genealogy of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron, Hezron of Ram, Ram of Abinadab, Abinadab of Nation, Nation of Salmon, Salmon of Boaz, Boaz of Obed, Obed of Jesse, and Jesse of David. And the fact that it ends at David here means that for the Old Testament people, it meant that David had Gentile background, intertribal background, and he was a kind of a racially a universal man, as you know, their belief was that he was a universal king, the great king of his time. For the Christian world, of course, Ruth has a somewhat different value, since David was one of the ancestors of our Lord, and we see that in two cases he has Gentile blood, Tamar and also Ruth. And also this means that he came of all of us and he died for all of us. One of the pretty books of the Old Testament and just fun to read on general principles. And you've been very great this morning. Hope it wasn't too long.
Yes. I had a question. As I understood it, Judaism, even to the time of Jesus was an active proselytizing religion. That people are, am I mistaken?
Was not. Not particularly, no.
But there were, I thought there were that the problem was when the they Greeks, were. I thought the problem with the Greeks, you know, one reason why Jesus was appealing to many of the Greeks was that one could take the Jewish law without the rules of eating and so on. That there was a group that accepted partially the Jewish culture and so on, but didn't want to accept the...
Well, there's a problem in the early Christian church with what do you do with the Old Testament law. But never at any time in their history were the Jews ever very evangelistic.
They well, I thought this too, but...
They weren't particularly interested. Now, there were certain times when they were more casual about interracial marriage than others. And of course, at the time of Christ, they were pretty well, you know, there were Jews scattered all over the known world. The largest concentration of Jews were in Babylon, because the cream of the crop never came back to Palestine. They stayed there. And that's where the best rabbinical schools were at the time of Christ. And Palestine was second rate, maybe even third rate, because there was a rather good rabbinical school in Alexandria, still living on the remains of what was left of the old library after a series of Macedonian and Roman generals had burned it up. And so, but there was a very strong ethnic consciousness, as there still is today. But there were certain times when they were more casual about marrying Gentiles than others. But there was no particular, and I think Naomi's talk to her daughters was rather typical of most Jewish sentiments. You know, you go to your gods. You're Gentile girls, you know, you just stay Gentiles. There are no particular effort to say, but, well, yeah, girls come with me because I worship the true God and your people worship idols. Mm-hmm. There's kind of an indifference about Gentiles. Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
In Matthew, it's going to tell me about the genealogy of...
Yeah.
Genealogy of Jesus, and talking about the father of Boaz and so on and so forth. But a nation or something. The father of Sam, the father of Boaz by Rahab. Now this Rahab, I was wondering, is that the Rahab that back in Joshua that
referred to it with Perez? Yeah. There's a discrepancy there, and nobody knows how to account for it. Then you also get discrepancies in the various genealogies in the Gospels, some of which is accounted for by saying, well, this is Mary's family tree, this is Joseph's family tree. They intersect, interestingly enough, at David. David is an ancestor of both. And, of course, to our modern thinking, say, well, what difference does Joseph's genealogy make? He's born Mary. But, they didn't think that way. Joseph was his official father, and so he had to be of the house and lineage of David. Yeah, the subject of genealogy is a quite different topic, and it's a topic that I don't know enough about to lecture about.